Who are you?
I'm the luckiest guy on earth.
I love it.
No, seriously, you know what? I just would be, you know, I've been blessed with an amazing past. I think when I pass, because I never use the words died or dead, because I believe we all just pass on. I think the minute I get to the gates, which I think I'm going to get to, I'm just going to look at God and I'm going to ask one question. Why me?
Hmm.
I mean, seriously, I mean, my whole life has just been a real blessing. Everything's just the faith base, and it sort of came my way. Quirks in time, I stepped into the right place at the right time, and I've just had this amazing life, and now I just realize it's, you know, I got later older in life, and it was time for me to give back.
Yeah.
You know, it's my turn, you know, it's my turn to use what I was blessed with to literally just give it all back.
Where does that, you know, I think of even the conversation we're having before I hit record, there's, you know, this, I forget the exact language you use, but it was just like, let's just let it flow. It all will lead to where it needs to lead.
Right.
Where does that come from, though? You know, where did you first really start to pay attention to that?
I think it was, I never paid attention to it later in life. Like I said, it just happened. And I realized later in life that looking back, that things are happening like they're supposed to. So I think if you don't let it go naturally, it's contrived. The minute you start saying, let's talk about this, let's talk about that, then you have to remember what you set up, and it just doesn't work. I mean, to me, it's just about, you know, you just got to be honest with yourself and everybody else and let it fly. And then it's natural and it's beautiful. If you try to make it something it's not, people see it. They see right through it. You know, Mark, they just do. So for me, it's just like, and I think a lot of it is confidence, just the confidence of knowing that, you know, what you are going to talk about will lead to beautiful stuff. And even if it gets negative or weird, if people learn from that negativity, it still turns it into a positive. So you just let it rock, you know, and just like you did, let's just be real about it. That's all.
Did you pick up any of that from your years on the stage?
Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, I think that all of us that were fortunate enough to be in that vein, especially with these creative giants that, you know, had were wired different in so many different ways that made it to that level. You learn a lot from them. You see how they approach things, and you saw when they hit a roadblock and you realized how what you had could help them. And together you created this thing that is still here today, and it's magical. And certain events that happen like that, you just don't forget. And we're creatures of habit. So if something was wrong, you try not to do it again. But if something's right, you try to replicate it. And in a different situation, and then it takes on something new, and it organically grows.
Yeah.
So yeah, of course, yeah. A lot of those early days when I was watching these writers write or get on stage and they would have a bad show, and then the next show they would correct it, and you help them correct it. So you learn from that. You learn from that, and you carry it on, and you learn from your mistakes, you know? Yeah, early on in my life where, you know, like I said, I was fortunate enough at a very, very young age to fall into the music business and really see a lot of that in early age. So I did. I carried a lot of that. A lot of those early,
yeah,
you know, those early teen, mid-teen things that I was seeing in music, I still carry today. Absolutely.
Help us, just for people that, you know, maybe didn't read the show bio and don't know your backstory and so forth. They're probably like, what are they talking about? Like, what stage? Like, what's going on? What are these guys talking? Paint the picture a little bit about life, you know, back in the day. I mean, you're still doing it, obviously, in a different capacity, but
yeah.
What were you doing, Leo? What were you doing? Who were you hanging with?
I was raised in a traditional Italian Catholic family. I was first generation American, and my parents all wanted for us the American dream. And I had two older sisters and an older brother, and later a younger brother. And they were all overachievers, and they were students, and they were very disciplined. And that was just not me. I think I was the black sheep. I don't know. But so I was never really a good student. So I was trying to find my way in this world where I was going to be. And for me, it was art and music, not because I liked it. It was art and music because it was easy. But then I learned to love the art and the music. When I was registering for high school, I had no idea what I was going to do with my life. In fact, I think my father he was in the longshoreman union in the business. So he had me lined up to be a longshoreman, which was big bucks where I was living in Southern California, in San Pedro. And, you know, I did art and music, and we went on a field trip to see a play at the old Long Beach Auditorium. And I didn't like the play, so I snuck backstage. I was going to leave, actually, but I ended up backstage by accident. And I got in trouble, and they gave, for my punishment, the drama teacher had told the technical director of the theater, he really likes this theater stuff, so as a punishment, maybe you should have him sweep the stage and empty the garbage cans. So that was my punishment. So I started being hanging around backstage more, and then the union stagehands would ask me to help them put up equipment, hang lights, and then they saw that I was very hard worker because I really loved it. So they put me in their apprenticeship program. So I was doing light operas and operas, but then they called me up and they said, hey, if you want, there's a band coming in next week and we don't like to work the rock shows. So why don't you and some of the other guys come down and you can unload the trucks and work and everything? And I said, sure, that'd be great. And you know, who is it? They said, oh, it's some band named Black Sabbath. And I went, oh, yeah, okay, I can do that. So yeah. we started working all the rock shows. You know, it was Black Sabbath, The Who, Deep Purple, Throw Tall, The Pointer Sisters, Beach Boys, Elvis. Everybody kept coming through. And we, as these young kids, I was 14 at the time, turning 15, we got to work all these shows.
Yeah.
So I kept seeing the same road crews coming through. There wasn't a lot back then. But me and the other guys, we could fix anything because we were really taught by the union guys. So they knew we knew what we were doing. So they started offering us tours. So I was too young. My father wasn't going to let me leave school. But after I graduated, I got a phone call and I was working local shows and doing some stuff around. Then I got a phone call from a lighting company, asked me if I wanted to go on tour. I said, sure. So I ended up going on my first tour at 18. I just turned 18. I was with The Who. So once I was on tour with The Who and I was working as a lighting person on The Who, which is, I was a dirty little grunt kid, first in, last out, putting lights up. Then after that, you sort of get this reputation of these kids. So then you started getting calls to work all these tours. And I just started touring and I just never stopped.
Well, I feel because I know a bit of your backstory, I feel like that's where that just flow and that faith comes in. Because it almost seems like you finished a tour and like you weren't 100% sure what, or maybe you didn't even know what was coming next. And next thing you know, phone rings, right?
Phone rings. I finished the Who tour and I had known the Fleetwood Mac guys from the fall of 1975. They were coming to the West Coast and they needed some lighting trusses, the thing to hold the lights. So I went out with them, spotted shows, and I would supply the trussing for them to hang their lights. So I kept meeting these guys. So as soon as I finished the Who tour, they called me and they said, hey, we're going to do a rehearsal. We need some lights. And the lighting company that I was working with got the same call. So we set up a rehearsal for them with lights. Now, the only deal was that Fleetwood Mac had no money at that time. So the lighting company did it as a favor, thinking they were going to get the tour, and told me that I can do the rehearsal, but I couldn't get paid. But I love Fleetwood Mac because I saw them coming through Long Beach. So I said, yeah, I'll do it. What the heck? I got nothing else going on. So I went in and I did it. And then the lighting designer had a relationship with Christine McVie, the keyboard player. And he had told Chris, hey, this kid just did this rehearsal. He didn't even get paid. He loves the band so much. So Chris called the rest of the band over and said, hey, do you hear this? This kid did this for free for us. And then John McVie, the bass player, said, then you have to go on tour with us. We're leaving in February. I said, you know, so right after the Who tour, I jumped on Fleetwood Mac and I ended up spending, you know, years with Fleetwood Mac on the road. I ended up as, you know, their tour director. I started off as a lighting and stage manager, the production manager. I was a tour manager. And my very last thing I did with them, I was the actual tour director. So I rode the whole gauntlet with them, but it was all from doing that rehearsal for free. If I would have said no, I don't know where I would have been.
Yeah.
So it was always that thing where I never had a reason that, you know, it was never about money. It was like, man, you know, I love the band. I mean, they were great. And then they picked up Lindsey Buckingham and Stevie Nicks, and it even just got bigger. And we all just, there was like six of us that were on the core crew, you know, and we just kept watching this thing grow and grow and grow. And we were going like, wow, yeah, we want to be part of this magic for sure.
Yeah, because when you met them, this wasn't the Fleetwood Mac that we knew. This was like a small crew, essentially, right? I mean, that's the thing people forget in these kind of stories.
There were guys coming in and out, but the six core crew that did like every show, there was six of us. There was a lot of guys that were coming in and out, but the six of us were like, I think I probably did more Fleetwood Mac shows than most people because I started in 75 and I ended in 93. The guy that took my place as a tour manager, Marty Hom, probably has as many shows as me. If we sat down, we joke someday we're going to sit down and, you know, maybe figure it out. There was even a time where their longtime tour manager JC wasn't on the Mirage tour and I was, so it's really weird to look at that dynamic, you know. But you know what, and it was all because I did a rehearsal for free, you know. I mean that was it, you know. But again, that was the same thing that took me back working in Long Beach for free. It was just, you know, I was just doing things because it felt good. And I knew we were all knowing we were a part of something that was growing, that was becoming very special. It was really, really, really cool to be involved, you know. And you know, I say this in my talks that you saw, we had fears, you know, and our fears was college, you know, or going a 9-to-5 job. We couldn't do that kind of, we weren't cut out to do that. So what was our option, you know, go to the army or something? No, it was, we found this rock and roll thing, this music. And we were fortunate. I don't say lucky. I say fortunate, you know? And the reason I say that is because, you know, if an opportunity comes your way and you're prepared, it goes like this. That's sort of the definition of fortunes and luck. So yeah. Everything that came my way, I found myself that I was prepared for it, and it just propelled me to the next thing. So yeah, so I ended up, you know, touring with a lot of bands for most of my life. So now, you know, after COVID, I didn't want to tour anymore. Quite honestly, how do I put this gently? I got tired of making millions for millionaires.
Yeah, fair.
And I wanted to use my energy in a much more positive way. So I started doing everything for, you know, I was done. I was retired. I didn't need anything in life. I was set. So I ended up doing I do all this for charity. So the Knights of Rock thing.
Knights of Rock. Yeah, yeah. Like, how did Knights of Rock materialize?
So this is an interesting story. Knights of Rock is a bunch of us that toured in the early 70s all the way up. Some of them are still touring, and most of us are retired. And we got together, and I'll tell you how we got together. But the reason we did Knights of Rock is because we wanted to tell the true, real story of classic rock. How it started, why it started, not the crap you read on the internet. So after I left Fleetwood Mac in 93, I started a record label, and it was all based around digital technology, converting analog signals to digital signals, sound, downloads. We had a label called the 5.1 Entertainment Group. It was me and the Fleetwood Mac producer, Cal A. And this studio just really, it took off. We ended up selling it. So when I sold it, I was still dabbling in managing bands. And I had this beautiful house on the Point in San Pedro, which overlooked the Pacific Ocean. It was an old 1904 cottage that the lighthouse watchman used to live in. And I got house. We call it the Point House, and it was my office. I used to, film companies would film there. They would do commercials. People would have meetings there. Bands would come and write, come fight, break up. It was just a place that, in fact, they filmed Top Gun Maverick there.
Oh, wow.
It's Penny's house, the Point House. So tour managers used to call me all the time and say, I'm in town, can I stay at the Point House? And I said, sure. Well, one night, about three or four or five of them called, and they all wanted to stay. And I said, sure. I said, so what I did is I catered a dinner. I said, yeah, come up. So-and-so here, so-and-so's in town. We'll have a dinner. So right before the dinner started, I took a DAT tape player. I put it behind the counter and I pushed record and literally got 6 hours of all of us just talking. So the next day I was driving to San Francisco and I was listening to it, and I realized it was really the true story. So I called two friends of mine. I called Mark Brickman, who's an amazing lighting designer for Pink Floyd and Bruce Springsteen and Paul McCartney, a good friend of mine. We did a lot of shows together. And I called one of my mentors, Jerry Levin, and I said, guys, I think I have something here. So I made cassettes and I sent it to them. And then Mark had the idea, says, you know, you have that 1931 Broadway, a Warner Brother theater down in Pedro. He goes, why don't you do this? He goes, why don't you call 10 guys that we all know and invite them for dinner, but tell them it's just you one-on-one.
So I did that.
9 guys at the table. And then Mark got some lighting. We got some cameras and we set it up. And one by one, these guys started showing up. Guys that hadn't seen each other in 15 years, 10 years.
Oh, wow.
And we walked into the theater and there was a dinner set up, and we taped it. We filmed it. Now, we didn't tape it for HBO specials. We didn't tape it for... We taped it because we wanted to tell the story that I had gotten on the tape. We did this in 2006, 20 years ago. So we edited it up and we put it on the internet with a password just for people to look at. And we were trying to think of... We really called ourselves Pirates of Rock. But Pirates was a little too edgy. So someone said, we're noble. Why don't we be the Knights of Rock? And I said, boom, that's it. So that's how Knights of Rock. And now what Knights of Rock is, it's just a bunch of us that we get together, all different, you know, I'll call 2 guys, 3 guys, 4 guys. We go and, you know, like if we do the Titans thing again, I want to bring 4 guys and I want to do the whole thing, because it's about teamwork. It's about hustling. It's about logistics. It's just this great how we pull this off. So Knights of Rock is just basically a bunch of guys that retired out of the business that just want to tell the true story of rock and roll. It's not about money. It's not about fame. It's just like 100 years from now, someone Googles classic rock. We want that to come up because we want to tell the true story. And that's Mark, that's what it is.
I love it.
And that's
I mean, we only have so much time, of course, and I want to talk about what you're doing also with your work around the world, but like what are some of those highlights of what the true story is?
It's about, you know, how we made sound smaller, but the size smaller, but it louder. How we went from traditional lights to moving lights, how we move things around the world those days when we were just absolutely, we didn't have the luxury of electronics and the logistics. We built stages and we did 7 shows a week. We take these stadium shows and we would be in a different city every day with massive amounts of equipment, you know, and it wasn't as technical. It was really raw. So, you know, but just not only that, it was just when a band had a song or something that they created something in the studio, which was much more advanced than the road. And they came back and said, well, how are we going to make this better for our live audience? They came to us and then we would create and we would, you know, we didn't have video walls like on the Fleetwood Mac Tusk tour. Instead of video walls, we needed a matrix to do a lot of things. So we had these roll drops and we had all these different designs and different textures and see-through pieces of material that were basically 30 feet high by 40 feet wide. Well, by a series of matrix of moving the fabric around with light, had thousands of looks, but it wasn't electronic.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know,
there's a rawness and like a organic, I want to say, to
exactly. So we would take 5 drops or 6 drops and we would put 3 down and then light it with something. It'd be something. And then the next song, you take 1 drop up and take another drop in and it would create something else. And so, you know, so we were figuring out ways to do exactly what they're doing today, but a very, very analog, rudimental way. So, you know, right now, sometimes I go to shows and I see all these lights and flashing. It drives me crazy because it takes away from the artist, man. We were just like, you know, just light them gently and let them be them. Don't suck the energy out of the friggin' show. Taylor Swift's amazing what she did on that Eras tour, but it's so much information overload. If you ask, name 10 songs that she sang, most people can't. Because you're bombarded. Yeah. But if you go to a Fleetwood Mac show from the 70s, you can name every song. If you go to the Eagles, every song. So it's a big difference, you know? It was the artist, it was their music, it was the lights, it was the sound. We worked together. It wasn't as sporadically, you know, just information overload junk. Yeah. Because we approached it that way. So big difference.
Well, I mean, what a lesson about, I mean, forget just music. I mean, everything that we're experiencing right now, present day, it's overloaded everywhere, right? I mean, there's the lesson is how do we have a little bit of balance or be intentional in the way that you guys were literally working these shows and kind of every aspect of life, right? To let the true thing shine.
Exactly. What you're saying, the true thing, because what we always say is this, no matter what you're doing in a concert or a music or an album, it starts with the song. It starts with the song. The song has to be good. The song has to be absolutely a hit. It has to be something that comes from the heart. That's what's going to resonate. You can have the shittiest song in the world with the most beautiful lighting and nobody cares. You can have the most beautiful song in the world that resonates someone's heart and have one incandescent light bulb and they're going to remember that song.
Yeah, so true.
We always say it starts with the music. It starts with the song. That's just the way it is. You know, when I was doing the technology switch, we had all these guys from Microsoft and Apple, and they had all these computerized noises, and they were like making all these noises and writing songs and stuff. And they thought they were like these big rock stars, and their songs were horrible, but they thought they were artists because they had these new computers that can make noises. And we used to have to say to them, that's a great sound, but boy, you're not a songwriter.
Yeah, exactly.
You're not a songwriter. So, you know, why don't you take that technology and give it to a good songwriter and let them twist it and turn it? So we were trying to educate them to work together with the artist, but also telling the artist, you maybe have to adopt a little bit of the new stuff that's moving forward, you know? So it's a whole transition thing that I think that us being back there and then having our thumb on the pulse of technology sort of made it easier to blend.
Sure. We met at a, I guess you can call it a business conference, or really, it's hard to give it a name. It was a pretty unique experience with some really wonderful CEOs and people doing great things in the world.
Amazing.
And I remember I had finished my presentation and then sat down. We were sitting beside each other, and part of the flow that I had was to identify that unsung hero in your life. And you turned over to me. You said Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys was that person for you. I bit my tongue, Leo, in that moment to ask why and ask further details. I had a feeling we were going to have this conversation. I wanted to save it for this interview. So I'm going to ask, I want to ask you that question now.
Why, Brian?
Yeah, yeah.
Because I think he's so deep and spiritual, and he's, you know, he's done so much for humanity. Forget music. I mean, everybody that's ever written a hit has been influenced by this genius man that grew up very insecure, very frightened, very, you know, from a broken family, really, because his father was a mensch to him. And but, you know, Brian took all that negative energy that was around him. And I think he was using his talents that were God-given to now take him to a spot where he could make a difference. By he would, to me, was the first person that I realized that could see things as they can be and not as they are. Mm. So he would look, you know, if he was writing a song, he already had the symphony in his head done, and then he would build on that. And he was never afraid to take chances. And then, you know, yes, you had the drugs, and you had, you know, and I worked with him early in my career, midterm in his career. But then I had the fortunate—I was fortunate to work with him later in his life on the 50th anniversary tour. And even then, I saw him do things in the studios 51 years after they did Good Vibrations, and he's doing the exact same thing he did back then in a modern world with analog equipment. And I realized that, you know, and I'll give you a good example. We were in the studio one day, and they were doing vocal overdubs, and it was a record that was called No Peer Pressure. It was Jeff Fosquet, who's no longer with us, God rest his soul, and Al Jardine and Brian, and they were doing vocals. And they had laid Brian's parts, and he'd sit on the couch, and I was sitting next to him, and he had this clicker that he could stop the session if he didn't hear something he liked. So Al and Jeff were singing background vocals, and it wasn't resonating. And I saw Brian look in the window, and he realized that they were on two microphones. So he clicked. He says, "No, no, 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 no. You guys got to be on one microphone." So the engineers, okay. The engineers came in, and they put Jeff and Al Jardine on one microphone, and they sang the part. And I was blown away how much better it was. It was amazing, sure. The difference, you know, because in his head he's seen and hearing something that, again, not as it is, but as it can be. And they're singing it. Now I'm going like, wow, this is great. But then they're singing it again, and he's still like fidgeting. And he clicks in and he says, "Jeff, you're singing the falsetto parts, which are the high parts," because Jeff took sort of Carl's job, and that Carl, Brian's brother. And he said, "Yes." And he says, "You're singing too loud. Can you back off the microphone about 3-4 inches? And then the engineer, Frank Pappalardo, he said, "Oh, I could take it down in the mix." And Brian says, "No, no, no, no. Leave the mix the same. Just, Jeff, just back up a little bit." And then Jeff backed up. And I, Mark, it was even better. I was like, my head went like, wow. You know, yeah. I mean, literally, I was like, so the session ended and I walked Brian to his car and I was sitting down with Al Jardine, the other, you know, the original, one of the originals of the Beach Boys. And I said, I'm blown away. What was that all about? And we were at Oceanway Studio, and he said, "It's exactly what we did in 1966 with Good Vibrations. We all around one microphone, and Brian knew how to do the arrangements, and he knew the dynamics of the microphones." And he looked at me, he says, "Probably the same microphone." But I mean, you know, so even later in life, you see how he was thinking, you know. And yeah, you know, he had his problems with the drugs, and he lost his faculties and the whole thing with Dr. Landy and all that. You hear all that stuff. But I don't think that takes away still from when he was younger, that he wasn't afraid to take chances. But most of all is we would be on tour, especially on the 50th anniversary, and everybody would come. I mean, I'm telling you, stars, movie actors, rock stars, famous rock stars, fighting to see Brian Wilson and meet him, you know. And then you would listen to like these great artists like Paul McCartney paying homage to a guy that says, "You wrote my favorite song, God Only Knows." And I'm sitting there just going like, damn, you know?
Yeah.
But I saw it over the years how, and then it really hit home on later in life from 2012 to about 2016 when I was able to really spend time. And he doesn't open up to everybody, but when you're on long bus rides or plane flights or and he really did open up, and you would listen to stories about the old days, even back to the original Beach Boys with the guitar player David Marks, which a lot of people don't even know was a Beach Boy, who was a huge, huge part of the Beach Boys sound, and how much Brian adored him and what David added to it. and you listen to some of the things that, like, Brian was writing Surfer Girl because he heard Carl and David across the street singing on acoustic guitars to Richie Valens' O'Donna, which is sort of the same type of song. But Brian told me, he says, yeah, I was listening to that, and I was in the middle of writing Surfer Girl, and it sort of took on the same vibe. And I'm sitting there just going, like, wow, you know, and I'm in a tour bus. So I called David. Yeah. I said, you remember that story? He goes, yeah, as clear as day. So there's all these things. But there's a lot of people, you know. I mean, there's a lot of people that, you know, Lindsey Buckingham, that whole thing, the way he plays guitar, the way he approached music, Evie and her subtlety, Christine McVie, the way she was sort of the master at putting things together, and John, you know, Fleetwood and McVie, the bass rhythm section, Prince, way ahead of his time, took the whole music business out of slavery and solitude because he was so confident in his self that he felt he could do no wrong. You know, and you saw what Prince did, and you just saw, if Jimi Hendrix was alive to see Prince, I think he would say that is the greatest guitar player that ever lived. So there's all these people that were coming out of my life, like the Chaka Khan, me touring with Chaka from Rufus all the way up to her solo career to I Feel For You, watching this woman, the most natural, talented female vocalist who could just go from a bottom G to a top G with the snap of a finger and not crack a note. And I'm like watching all this in my little world and translating it into helping, seeing those experiences and helping other people with what I've seen through that. So sort of.
How do you summarize it all, Leo? Like, I mean, those years and those experiences, like, is there a word that just comes to mind for you?
Magic.
Magic.
Yeah. So that's all true. I can say. It's just magical. You know, there's just no other word I can say than just, you know, do you believe in magic? Yeah, I do. Because it was magic, man. It was just like, it's unexplainable.
You know, when you say that, what comes to mind is a little bit more present day, and just because we had this experience together, and I'd love for you to share, you know, some of the work that you're doing around the world, helping communities and kids and so forth. And what happened for those listening, I mean, you were looking at raising some funds and some money for a bridge in El Salvador, and I'll let you explain that situation. But the magic that happened in that room was, as you know, you sharing your whole backstory and what you're doing and sharing how much a bridge like that costs, and almost, you know, instantly, you know, one of the individuals in the room said, I got the bridge. Like, don't worry about that.
I know.
And it just felt like, wow, okay. That's like the other version of magic in your life. Completely different worlds, of course.
You know what?
But it just like finds you.
I was like on a magic carpet. I looked at my wife and she was crying because it was unbelievable. Let me tell you how it all started. So I have five children. I have four boys and I have my baby girl, my miracle, I call her. My oldest son, Ryan, succumbed to cancer. He passed away. And before, he was a professional soccer player in Spain, and then he became a singer-songwriter within my record label, and he really, really was successful at that. And somehow, his music got to members of the Peace Corps, and they were sharing his music around the world. He had this network of Peace Corps people that were, they share stuff. So he had a friend of his that was in the Peace Corps in El Salvador, and he called her, and he said, look at it. He says, I see you're on this. He goes, what's this Peace Corps thing all about? And she told him, and she said, why don't you come down to El Salvador, and you could see for yourself, because I can't explain this, you come down. So we went down to El Salvador, and this is before Ryan was sick with the cancer, and we realized that the extreme poverty around the world, El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, there's some very, very poor regions, as poor as Africa. So I went down there going like, hey, we can do a documentary and sell records. And then we came down there, we came back. And so my son Ryan dedicated his life to changing the world one child at a time by removing kerosene lamps with solar powered lamps, water filters so they didn't have to boil the water, and they could catch the rainwater and sanitize it. And they didn't have to walk to the river and get polluted water, medicine. They didn't buy kerosene. Then they could buy clothes. They could buy bus fares. They can go to school. They had no future. They were picking coffee beans for all the people in the world. So, you know, and he said, you know, I got lucky. I was born in America. My grandfather came to America and gave me a life, but these kids, they're just unlucky. So he made it his mission and then when he contracted the lymphoma cancer, and he knew that he wasn't going to make it, which he had this premonition he wasn't before he even had the cancer. He didn't ask me to carry on the foundation. I think he knew I was going to, you know.
Oh, interesting.
Now, at the same time, my new wife, she had a son and his name was Nicholas. And when we reconnected over a period of years, and she lost a son to cancer too, the same kind of cancer. Wow. So her and I, we just sort of sat back one day when we started doing this, when Knights of Rock started to get into a spot to where we just said, man, we can't let our children's names pass in vain. Mm-hmm. And we're going to make it our mission to use what they've started and what they've done to make the world a better place. We raise money for the foundation, and we've done so much. Now, the one thing that we don't do is we don't put it up on the internet. We don't brag about ourselves. We don't say, look at us. We don't go chasing money like, hey, we need donations. That's not what Ryan wanted. I used to have this saying, I want to be judged by our actions and not by our hype. And we're only going to be successful when we can say no to Oprah.
Yeah.
And that's what it's become. So we have done a lot of charitable. And the bridge you're talking about was when we were there in 2010, there was this 14-year-old kid. His name was Edwin Rivera. And Edwin was this little super kid that had a vision for his community that was Chachulapa in El Salvador, one of the most poverty riveted, murder capital of the world. And this little kid had a dream. And so my son Ryan saw his dream, and he gave him his guitar. And he said, whenever you're struggling, you play this guitar and it'll help you and it'll save you. So over the years, Edwin grew and he graduated school early and he became this community activist, this leader. So he would call me and say, hey, I need some money to do this or I need some money to do that. So we kept feeding him the money. He kept getting stuff done. So in the winter of 2024, he calls and he said, we had a tragedy down here. He says, between San Sebastian and San Juan, there's a river, and they had this bridge, and it was just wires with wood. Well, these kids were crossing to go to school, and a flash flood came and washed them away. So he asked me, can you send some money so I can build a really strong iron bridge that's high enough it'll never fall in any storm? So I said, sure. So he sent me a picture of what it was. Mm-hmm. And then I said, okay, well, tell me what you need. And he followed up with the pictures of the beams, the cement, the wire, the flooring, everything. He says, this is what I need. Minimized out how much it costs. So I asked him the biggest part. I said, what about the labor? Both communities will do the labor for free. So I did it in tranches and I gave him the money. And then for every time he progressed, we would send him more. And literally, Mark, in less than 3 months, they had the bridge finished.
Wow, right.
So they wanted to name it. They wanted to name it after my son, Ryan. They wanted to call it the Ryan Rossi Bridge. And I said, my son wouldn't want to do that. So since we're passing from one community to the other and my son passed, let's call it the Angels Bridge. Mm. So we called it the Angels Bridge, you know, for the people that helped me donate it, you know, donated to bridge. Their names are on the back of the plaque. We'll go down there. We're going to dedicate the bridge once we get out of this crazy government stuff. But now that bridge is there. You saw the pictures. It'll be there forever. So now when that gets around, Edwin says, hey, I have another community that's even worse. I have a school that needs to be reopened. I have a medical clinic here. And it's not only in El Salvador. In Cambodia, we have a partnership with International Medical Relief out of Denver. And they help communities around the world with, like, we supply these hand crank flashlights. We're sending some to Jamaica right now because it's been 6 months since the hurricane. They still have no power. So we're sending 600 flashlights to them. We had this initiative in Cambodia. We had these two twins and they had this skin disease where the dead cells didn't fluff off. And they were looking like leopards. So they wanted to try this red light therapy. They needed two red lights in the medicine. And they asked us for the funding and we gave them the funding and it worked. So now we're going to, with International Medical Relief, we're going to expand that project. They found out, I think it's something to do with the water table. But now we're funding all these little things all around based on the Knights of Rock. Knights of Rock feeds the charity, which is Just Love It, which is what Ryan named it. So that's how we're doing it. So the reason we go out and we do these things, and, you know, when I went to the Titans, you know, it was like, what do you want out of this? They asked me, and I said, I just want to pitch my initiative, and I think that people understand what our mission is. If they do or if they don't, it doesn't matter. I think it's a great opportunity. And when I was on the stage and, you know, they all said, I'm in, I was just like, wow, you know, because I told them, you heard what I told them. I said, you know, we're in this room together doing this because we are the chosen few. We are the ones that are blessed enough that can make a difference if we just make the difference. And I think that they saw that I had a quantified success and I had experience doing it. It was easier for them. So we're really excited about the future. And, you know, of working this whole thing through Knights of Rock, through the Just Love It organization. And it's really it's a blessing, you know, it's a blessing to think that it all came from classic rock. All this happened from me at 15 years old, walking through a door.
I can't help, but I mean, even gosh, how we open this conversation and just this, the feel, like people can feel it through the way that you tell these stories and how you show up as a human. There's a presence. And I think that's what those individuals also felt was, you know, you're doing this work and of course your son started it and there's that whole story there, but even through everything you shared with being, you know, with those bands and going, like, there's this felt presence of that, the chosen few, like even with the bands, like knowing that, like literally these songs have changed and created culture and like being part of that and everyone's got their role. And I just see all of that just rippling out into what you're doing today. It's just a different medium, right?
Again, it's and it's funny to think that all of this that we're doing right now literally was divine intervention because I walked through a door. Yeah. But I'll see, you know, I tell people this story sometimes of the early days of Fleetwood Mac when they were finding themselves and the first record was done and they're getting into the second record and they knew that it had to do something that was going to be a follow-up because the first record with Stevie and Lindsey had success. And we were in North Carolina, we were doing a show and the band had done a sound check and Stevie was done and she was in the dressing room. Back then, we didn't have a lot of fancy dressing rooms, and she was playing a guitar, but she was listening to a band called The Spinners, R&B. And it was a pretty bassy beat, but she started playing guitar around it. And Rhino, the stage manager, said, hey, he called her Stephanie. He said, Stephanie, would you want a piano? And she said, do we have one? She said, yeah, we have a little electric one in the truck. So he said, me, the kid. He goes, kid, will you go get the piano out of the truck? So I did, and I set it up for her. And she's playing along with The Spinners track. And she's playing F and G, the song, the chords F and G, and she's playing and she's playing and she's playing it. And I feel this, you know, she didn't realize that the F and G was the first time she ever started working out the chord structures for the song Dreams, which is the biggest Fleetwood Mac hit. So here's me and Ron Penny, Rhino, the stage manager, and we're there listening to the first chord structures. And then she takes that and she goes to the studio and she finishes the track. It becomes their biggest single hit, right? Well, the only number one song they had. So sometimes my wife and I, we were sitting at a coffee shop at a Starbucks and we're sitting waiting for a COVID test or something back then. And there was these millennials and the young girls and there a table across and Dreams came on and they were arguing about the song. Was it Stevie solo? Was it a Fleetwood Mac track? And they're talking about this thing and we're just sitting there going, and I'm sitting there going like, they're 10 feet from the real story, you know?
Yeah.
And we just look at each other and we just sort of smile, you know? And you just sit there and you just go, those are the moments where you're just going like, wow. You know, so I need to use that to do something really positive, you know, and that's where you know, like I said, to me, it's a divine intervention. It's destiny. And it's like this stuff was given to me for a reason. But I really want to ask God, why did you choose me? There's other guys that you chose too, but specifically why me? I want to know was it someone in my past? Was it something in my future? What did you see that gave me this amazing life? You know, I mean, it's crazy. It really is crazy. It's why, you know, people come up and they ask for stuff and I don't mind just doing whatever they need if we feel it's right. And, you know, you do have your scammers, you know, you do, but it's about giving back, you know, right now.
Yeah.
Our own little way, you know, sometimes I look at the music business, I get frustrated because I think if I went back into the music industry, I would try to do something totally impossible, make it like it was. It's never going to happen. The times have changed. One of the reasons why I stopped touring, I kept going back and trying to change the world if you just do it our way, they don't even want to know about it. So you just give up. So you went on to something else and you use that energy to try to do something better, you know?
But you're still just, I get the sense, and I wonder if you think about this or it just happens naturally. I feel like you're just, you're capturing the magic in as many moments as possible. I mean, what a gift to be able to have that. I mean, you've been surrounded by it, but it seems like it's just built into your DNA at this point, right?
Like, well, then again, you see, I hear you say that you're capturing the magic, you know? To me, I see it in a different way. The magic's capturing me. It's reversed. It's totally reversed. I'm not capturing anything. I'm not going out there going like, hey, here I am. No, it's coming my way. The magic is capturing me. It's a completely reversal. And then when you put those elements together, you're able to do something that's very, very special. That is, you really feel that you're making a change in the world, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's sort of my outlook on it, man.
I can't think of a better place to wrap the conversation, but I definitely do want to provide the opportunity, you know, if there's anything else you'd like to say, Leo, or share with us. For me, it's just been, I knew when I first met you that we would have a real heartfelt conversation. And at least
yeah,
for me,
no,
that's
it was great.
We had a great
time there. Yeah, I'd like to leave it with this. Anybody who's watching this podcast, and I appreciate you doing this because I think the podcast is, you know, and I say this a lot, and you heard me say it to the Titans, you know, the biggest poverty in this world right now, it's feeling unwanted. It's feeling unvalidated. It's feeling like you don't belong. The future is so difficult if you're facing it alone. All of us that are fortunate to have these opportunities and, you know, it's our responsibility to try to right the wrongs and make the world a better place, but it's so simple to do. A lot of people, I don't have time, I'm busy, I'm this and that. You're not too busy that you can't, you're driving somewhere and you see a school. Stop into the school, put a couple hundred dollars on the counter and say, can you pay a lunch fee? Can you pay a book fee? Because that's going to help some child. Or, you know, if you can, go to a youth center, turn your friggin' TVs off. Let's stop watching the news, the networks. If you can go to a youth center and just play kickball or go to an art class or give these children what we had when we were young and help them find their way with the gifts that we have because of the situation we're in, man, I believe that these children coming forward won't forget these things and then they'll pay it forward. And you never, ever, ever, ever know which child you're going to help. One of these days, it's going to be, you know, it's like when my son Ryan, he did an interview once and we were in El Salvador and the interview asked him, said sort of like, you're very arrogant. You think you could save all these children. And my son looked at me and he sort of smirked. He says, nope. He says, you have to understand. I come from a world where one person can make a difference. I don't have to save all of them. I have to save as many as I can because I'm going to save the right one, the doctor, yeah, the lawyer, the politician, the actor, the actress. So I have to keep going. So when you do what I'm telling you, if you go to a school or you pay a book fee or you never know who you're helping, that kid could become somebody. That child could be somebody that is so strong that's going to change the world. And I guarantee you, they will not forget that person they know or that anonymous person they didn't know that helped them. You just don't know. So we can't stop trying. So I'm telling everybody, just make the effort. That's the simplest thing I can say. Make the effort. It doesn't, you don't have to sit there and you don't have to, you know, teach them how to read math. You could do that if you want, but man, if you just stop by a school, there's so many kids that need help. One small thing you can do will change a tumbler's of time. And don't think that if, you know, don't think that you can't. Don't think that it's not. It will. You just got to make the effort. That's it. Everybody makes an effort, the world will change. That's it. Simple.
Well, you definitely lead by example, Leo, and I thank you for making time to come on this show, but a higher thank you for everything that you're doing, everything you're putting into this world, for making that decision so many years ago to walk through that door and continuing to walk through the door. I mean, the ripple effect, right? You can't even measure the ripple effect of that decision on so many people's lives around the world. So thank you for that.
It's like I said, you know, you and I come together at a conference. We don't know each other. And here we are. And your podcast is going to go out to many, many people. And if three of those people find this and do something with it, that's where it starts to go like this, man.
Yeah.
So
exactly.
It all happens for a reason.
Incredible. Until next time.
Rock and roll.